For some, the urge toward storytelling is nigh irresistible, an almost instinctual compulsion that, to the exclusion of all else, demands sating. Certainly, I am no stranger to such impulses. But, for reasons best left in the shadows from whence they came, after a series of long and rather stern lectures by a gaggle of attorneys and advisors, it has been made clear to me that I am no longer permitted to tell true stories. But, and though I could hardly recommend ignoring the advice of skilled counselors, I am not above occasionally bending their dictates just a little. But let us come back to that point presently. The relationship between storyteller and audience is necessarily distant, and in my case, necessarily more distant and lonely than most, but I should very much like to imagine it otherwise. So, I hope to have a particular conceit of mine indulged. Ensconced alone here in my writing retreat, high in the Alps and far from prying eyes and listening ears, sitting by my fire, I shall imagine myself holding court for you instead. Nevertheless, I find I must completely abandon the labels based on a true story, or even inspired by true events. But how much of a sacrifice is this, really? After all recollection is, in some sense, a species of fiction. With apologies to L.P. Hartley, the past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. But with those disclaimers out of the way, perhaps we can indulge in a bit of conspiracy together, you and I. And if you are of a mind to indulge me, I will impart to you my mostly true and substantially accurate stories. I'm Isabella Valeri, and you're listening to Memories from Foreign Pasts. My writing retreat is almost too isolated. Nestled in the high Alps, at more than 3,000 meters, not quite 10,000 feet, the only practical way up is to ride a little cable car, operated for the last 40 years or so by the same highly misanthropic family. One calls for the cable car on an old analog phone at the base of the lift. As a rule, the family is deeply suspicious of outsiders. The little car is only large enough for two people at a time, or one with a few bags from the little market in the village. And as it passes the family's house, the patriarch will slow the cable down, peer out of the nearest window with a frown, and scrutinize the occupants before sending the car to the top. If nothing else, that makes my little alpine chalet rather private, and I would have it no other way. Fogs in the valley below are common, even in December, and the snowfalls in my retreat's little corner of the Alps can be famously heavy. The blankets of white dampen their surrounds. Even the brilliance of the Saturday night lights from the village at the valley's end, even the din of ski tourists on their many gleeful entertainments, will not reach my mountain enclave after the weather has been heavy. But the still and the quiet is conducive to writing. And that, of course, is the point. Sitting at my desk, wrapped in quilts, and with only the occasional crackle from a little fireplace for company, I find I am able to create some of my best prose. On the other hand, the leap from comforting privacy to isolating loneliness is altogether brief. After the more intense of winter storms, supplies to my little chalet and the four others on the other side of the ridge must be flown in by helicopter, and it is not unknown for me, scarcely noticing, to pass a week or even two without human contact. Other times, however, the craving for human contact grips me much sooner, And it is the tale of one of those instances. My first memory of a foreign past, entitled New Year's Eve, that I should rather like to share with you tonight. Towards the end of December 2023, just before signing with Simon & Schuster for my first two novels, I was invited to enjoy the most charming dinner at a chalet down in the valley with some of the most delightful guests. It was the night before New Year's Eve, and after dinner, and quite a lot of wonderful wine, somehow, I found myself telling the story of Caesar's civil war and, in particular, the Battle of Pharsalus, wherein Caesar defeated Pompey Magnus. Curiously, most rapt among my audience were the Lady Josephine and Imperator Wallace, who had been invited along with their elders. But that is another tale. It was well after midnight when I made my way back up to my retreat, drawing an annoyed scowl from the patriarch against the uncommon hour I had forced him to rise. Sleep was elusive, as I yearned for the food, the wine, the warm lights of the chalet, the dinner conversation, and the company of others I had so enjoyed. I rose quite late the next day to find snow already falling, and whiled away the hours doing very little until the early evening when, desirous of company once more, I endured the long, snowy trip in the cable car and down the winding patch to the village below. Once there, I found myself at my favourite little Glühwein stand, bundled up under the complimentary furs, hands wrapped around a steaming cup, occasionally brushing the odd, oversized snowflake from my eyelashes. I am not by nature a social animal. I am shy, even skittish in crowds, or just small gatherings in closed spaces. Despite this, as I imagine many authors do for inspiration, I thoroughly enjoy people watching, not to mention indulging in my very favourite vice, eavesdropping. And so, entertained by a sporadic conversation with the proprietrix of the Glühwein stand, I absorbed as much as I could of the assortment of skiers, locals, on tourists, in the wind-up to midnight and the impending transition from New Year's Eve to New Year's Day. Lost in my own thoughts and imaginings launched by the gleeful patrons around me, I passed the hours that way, a more or less invisible observer. New Year's Eve can be anticlimactic in small alpine villages. Most barn fireworks or garish light displays. Moreover, snow had been falling heavily for hours. After a series of unsynchronized countdowns to midnight, obviously many visitors did not possess the obsessive dedication to precision timekeeping cultivated by the locals. Little knots of fives and sixes would break off from the larger collection of people and drift away into the snow, bound for one of the few nightclubs on what passed for a main street, or their own private parties in the hotels and chalets of the village. It was quickly quiet, dark, and lonely once more. It was perhaps an hour after midnight when I drained my last Glühwein, extracted myself from the furs, tipped the proprietrix, who, perhaps detecting how lonely I felt, had kept the stand open an extra half an hour just for me, and started back for the cable car and home. It was dark, that dark of the deeply rural, and the snowfall had only intensified since I had come down. It was quite a challenge to trudge the 3 kilometres, nearly 2 miles, through the drifts, on so to the base of my lift. It was quiet too, with only the creak of the snow under my fur-lined boots as I compacted it with each footfall. The phone at the base of the cable car was working fine, but the other end only rang and rang. I must have spent 15 minutes trying to reach the gatekeepers of the path that was my only way home. to no avail. Perhaps, I thought, they had absconded for their own mysterious New Year's Eve rituals. It wasn't the first time I had been stranded in the village late at night, but finding a vacancy in any of the hotels or guest houses would prove impossible on a fully booked occasion like New Year's Eve. Still, with nothing else to do, I started back towards the way I had come. In the distance, the village was even quieter and darker than when I had left, and that unnerved me. I had visions of lost Arctic expeditions, of bodies frozen in the drifts, lost to the world until the spring thaws, and worse, of the ghosts of those who had gone before me and also found themselves lost in the snow until gripped by the warm embrace of hypothermia and the eternal sleep that followed. A little more than halfway, I had fallen into that particular trance that one does when walking alone and in silence. Wary of the hypnosis that can doom hikers, twice I stopped to break up the monotony, to close my eyes and listen to the quiet of the night, a stillness disturbed only by the soft hiss. There is nothing else quite like it, of snow falling onto fresh, virgin drifts. I was perhaps halfway to the village when something curiously warm intruded on the cold colour tones of fresh snow on the ground, on the branches of the towering European larch trees that lined my route. It was subtle, a strangely orange or yellow tint that added a sort of blush to the blues and whites of nocturnal, snow-covered alpine forests. As I waded through and over a large drift, I saw the source, a lone chalet, perhaps small enough to be called a cabin, just to the uphill side of the village-bound path I was trying to navigate. The warm yellow-orange of incandescent lights and a flickering fire was emanating from two little windows on the open front door behind a little porch. Thrown onto the reflective white of the snow, it seemed to cast an inviting aura across the surrounding landscape. Everywhere, there was the scent of wood smoke and, from within, the sounds of women's voices, laughter, and soft singing, the trappings of revelry. As I drew near, the charming scene coaxed a thin smile out of me. But the village was my destination, and so to avoid destruction, I pulled my jacket's fur hood tighter around my head and steeled myself to finish my trek so I could begin to work the problem of overnight accommodations. Much to my surprise, and just as I came to the closest approach to the little chalet, a woman's voice called out. Having no notion that the figure could be calling out to me, a transient interloper at best, I paid it no mind and made to continue on my way. Julia, the voice called, louder this time. She was on the little porch, just barely sheltered from the snows by the tiny roof above. She was clad in a winter sweater, with a high turtleneck bunched up around her neck under rosy cheeks. She stood from the wooden chair she had been sitting in, and held aloft a steaming mug, as if offering me a toast. I looked on in amazement, beginning to suspect for the first time that she might be addressing me. "Where have you been?" she demanded, but not in an unkindly way. It must have appeared comic, the way I looked behind to see if there was someone else in the dim night that the strange woman might be calling to. "Well," she said, "get back in here. Laura too has two more bottles open." With this, the figure turned on her heel and slipped through the open door and into the chalet. Not wanting her confusion to persist, I made my way to the little chalet, almost tripping on the snow-covered stairs to the little porch. Once I recovered, I knocked on the open door. From inside, the faces of five 20-something women, all clad in holiday sweaters turned to me at the same moment. "Julia," they all cooed, mostly in unison. As will happen in small chalets, the warmth of the fire had turned the main room sweltering for anyone wearing a heavy coat. It reddened my cheeks immediately, and about to explain that I was not, in fact, this Julia person, I pulled down my fur hood. Almost as one, each of their faces scrunched up into confused looks. "You're not Julia," one of them said. "Alas, no," I confessed. "But you're wearing her jacket," another insisted. "No," a third interjected. "Julia wears Canada Goose." "It looks the same to me," the corrected woman mumbled. I turned to the young woman who had called to me from the porch. "I didn't mean to intrude on your private evening," I said, "but I wanted to correct your error." "Your accent is so elegant," she said. "Are you from England?" "No," I admitted. "I have a place up the mountain." "A local?" one of the women marveled. "Do you know the best places in town to go dancing tomorrow?" "You mean the village?" I said, and then regretted correcting her. "Yes, sorry. I mean, we looked all over town. I mean the village. And couldn't find anything fun after, like, 11 at night. Tonight is our last night in this place, but we'd still like to go out tomorrow." "Well, there are a couple of nightclubs that are still open till 2 or 3, maybe," I said, despite having never set foot in them. "They are away from the center square, though. You have to know where to find them." "Want to come dancing with us?" my inquisitor said. "Amanda, sheesh," another scolded. "Give the poor woman room to breathe." "You look so cold," the woman who had called to me from the porch said. "Come and sit down by the fire." "No, really," I protested. "I have to be going." "Don't be silly," she said. "We have champagne, mulled wine, some vodka. What would you like?" "I couldn't," I started, but she cut me off. "I said, don't be silly. Come and sit down." It was an uncomfortable moment for an introvert like me, but at the same time, it was flattering and charming that these strangers should be desirous of my company. And so, allowing my coat to be taken, offering no protest when I was led to a chair by the fire, and enduring the fawning of my new acquaintances, I found myself sitting comfortably with a white wine glass posing as a champagne flute in my hand. "I'm Laura One," the girl from the porch offered, by way of introduction. She was a pretty blonde with dark eyes and a soft smile. "That's Laura Two," she said, indicating a much shorter brunette who, wielding various bottles at various moments, appeared to be tasked with refreshing the drinks of those assembled. And there is Amanda, who was almost class president, Kate, who just broke up with her boyfriend because of this trip, and Tina, who came up with the trip idea in the first place. "Tina, I guess that makes you responsible for Kate's breakup." "He was wrong for you anyway," Amanda insisted. "Not the smartest boy you've ever been with," Laura too added. And just like that, the awkward opening moves of social introduction melted away. The speed and ease with which they integrated me into their little clique left me dazed. Certainly, in my own circles, an outsider could linger for months, even years, and not find any warmth or acceptance. But for the 5 American girls who, as I quickly learned, had attended Dartmouth together, there were no thoughts of social caution or conversational reticence. It was their first trip to Europe, Laura One was quick to inform me, but their 4th annual pilgrimage together. Their little pack had made a pledge at graduation. Every year they would leave the real world behind and travel together, such that their fellowship would never be forsaken. Not half an hour later, they were teaching me to play Bullshit, a game based on card counting, on bluffing which, much to the amusement of my fellows, for how bashful I was to do it, required the enthusiastic outburst of Bullshit as part of regular play. Naturally, The game also mandated drinking as a penalty for setbacks. Only an hour and a great deal of alcohol later did someone bother to count the cards in the deck that had come with the rented chalet, on discover that there were only 47. An abortive effort to play Cluedo, the German version of Clue, only served to accelerate our drinking. But it was New Year's Eve, and that was okay. The wee hours descended into boozy bouts of remember when, retrospective tales that were hard for me to relate to, having never been to Dartmouth, on being unfamiliar with any of the personalities, mostly former boyfriends or unrequited crushes, that served as the major characters in many of their remembered stories. Laura One, apparently their unofficial leader, and who had made a point of sitting on the floor next to the chair I occupied, did a serviceable job of filling in the blanks with whispered asides. Like some United Nations translator converting the many idioms of their little coven into something accessible to me. When it came to me, they had their curiosities, of course. I deflected what I could, and felt guilty for being so reticent when they were so open. But there was, and is, very little of my past that I can share with outsiders. Of my origins, only my fictive persona, an invention of the last decade, still survives. Still, my hostesses took it all in stride. Never, I think, quite realizing that I, who still find myself drawing skeptical looks from hotel waiters who scrutinize my identification when I order martinis, was quite a bit older than they, and mistaking my reticence to share tales of my past for youth and inexperience, instead of the thorough whitewashing my colorful history has been subjected to. The circle grew physically closer as we approached 3 and then 4 in the morning, closing in on itself until the 6 of us were lying across each other in a sort of puddle of bodies in front of the fire, telling jokes, overturning each other's drinks, giggling, and exchanging whispered tales of invented hauntings. I woke with the pre-dawn, reclined on the little couch on the far side of the chalet's main room. I was alarmed to have fallen asleep in their company, to have left myself so vulnerable among strangers. But they had apparently done me no ill, even going so far as to put a quilt over me after I had slipped away. Laura, too, was curled up in a chair near the fireplace, only glowing embers left within, her slumbered breathing barely audible. An empty white wine glass balanced precariously on the thin arm of her chair. After I collected myself and peeked my head into each of the chalet's 3 cramped bedrooms, I saw that the remaining 4 had retired to 2 of them, wound up 2 apiece into tight little knots to fit within the absurdly narrow spaces that the Europeans have the gall to call double beds. The 3rd bedroom was empty, and I was sorely tempted to collapse into it and snatch a few more hours of sleep. But, perhaps uncountably, I felt I had intruded enough on my most gracious hostesses, and I was badly missing my own cozy nook on the safety and comfort of my own bed. I collected my coat, put on my boots, crept out and, under twilight skies, made my way back to the base of my cable car. It was one of those nights when the raw volume of drinking causes one to wake up still intoxicated. I must have tripped and fallen into powdery banks 3 or 4 times, throwing snow into my boots, down my neck, and into the sleeves of my coat. I waved enthusiastically, but the patriarch gave me a sourer look than normal, as it came even with his window. But he did not stop my car at his little inspection station. Once back in my retreat, I slipped away into a deep sleep. The sun was setting when I finally roused again. Hunting for my keys, I found a slip of paper in one of the pockets of my coat. It was a hastily scrawled note written on a lined scrap. "Come dancing with us. Call my cell," it read. On the sentence had been underlined 4 times. It was signed Laura One. At the bottom was a phone number. But the snow I had picked up during my several falls had apparently melted, and the ink at the bottom of the note had been washed away. The next morning, I dropped by the chalet, but, of course, I found it empty. And the rental services company had obviously cleaned it out the day before. It was only many months later that, with a startled waking as from a sprawling nightmare, I wondered what had become of their missing sixth, Julia. And so, almost exactly a year later, once more on New Year's Eve and from my Alpine writing retreat, I remember the jump from 2023 to 2024 and hope that Lady Josephine, Imperator Wallace, their elders, the Dartmouth Five, and especially the lost Julia, find themselves in warm and friendly environments to enjoy the passage into the new year. And to all of you, thank you for sharing with me my first memory of a foreign past, and I wish you the very best for 2025.